talk about the intro, but, I mean, like I said, occasionally we have guests, so I'm not just even hearing my own name, so, you know, but like I said, I've got one talk of a story that connects you to me some 42 years ago, but again, I'm going to put that, I'll let that
scare
me. No, man, it's great.
Well, that's all right.
But anyway, Rock Under Fire, Mike DiRico, I'm flying solo today. I'm with Robert Duncan. Or actually, I should say that Robert Duncan is calling in, because that's the way we've been doing things lately, ever since these the shutdowns began. I've been doing these as just phone calls, and
gotcha.
You know, and I've got an air conditioner roaring in the background, so hopefully it doesn't sound too bad. But
it's over 100 here today, so
yeah, we're not quite in the hundreds, but man, it's hot as balls,
and our internet is going on and off all day, so.
Oh,
that kind of sucks.
Man, I should have recorded that. I should have recorded the part about Penn Station, you know, because it was just segue into New York City. But Robert Duncan, Cream Magazine's former managing editor, described as a lifelong rock and roll obsessive, a musician himself who has been in and around the rock and roll world through some pivotal years, perhaps through rock's most hedonistic period. Besides Cream, he has contributed to notable publications such as Rolling Stone, Circus, Life. He is the author of books such as The Noise, Notes from a Rock and Roll Era, Only the Good Die Young, The Rock and Roll Book of the Dead, the very first book ever written on Kiss, and has now, after decades, written his first novel. Loudmouth is a story about sex, drugs, attempted murder, successful arson, love, hate, faith, fraud, family, Springsteen, Clash, Stones, Cream Magazine, Lester Bangs, New York, Detroit, Memphis, and Buck Teeth from Three Rooms Press. And you, Robert Duncan, came from Minnesota to New York City at what? Almost around the same time that Bob Dylan did.
Yeah.
Except
yeah.
You were in what, fourth grade?
I came in fourth grade, yeah. I came in fourth grade.
That's like 9 and 10 years old, right? That's like
I was 9 years old when I came to New York. And, yeah, that was the year, I think Dylan's first album came out in 61. And, I can't imagine listeners thinking of somebody from 1961. But, yeah, I was alive then.
Was it total fucking culture shock, man? What does a move like that do to a 10-year-old going from...
Well, coming from rural Minnesota, where I would get on my bike in the morning, you know, in the summer, and get on your bike, and you just ride your bike all day, and there wasn't really a lot of people around. It hadn't, but the area was later developed, but it wasn't developed so much when we were there, and, it was an hour drive into Minneapolis from where we were. Now it's probably 20 minutes. But, and then, so I was used to playing outside, and in the winter we made snow forts and all that, so, and you go on, the lake is frozen, so you drive your car on the lake, it was, or your parents did. And coming to New York at that age from that environment was, I'm like, well, wait a second, where do you play, I'm like, I just see streets around. But the thing about, kids that young is within a few months you've adapted. And I remember one of the neighbor kids is showing me how you can, there was dog shit everywhere in the street. New York was way dirtier than it is now. And people, people throw their trash in the streets and there's this dog shit everywhere.
I remember that. In fact, I got a chapter called Dog Shit and Litter. Of the 70s, man. But you're talking
that
60s.
That was it.
In the 70s, man. Nobody cleaned up after the dog. You finished a McDonald's. You finished McDonald's, man. A hamburger. You threw the fucking bag out of your car into the
onto
the freeway,
man. And it was Lady Bird Johnson, the first lady, Lyndon Johnson's wife, who kind of did that keep America beautiful thing, and they really came down on trash. And you know what? People forget it made a huge difference. As dirty as some places are today, you should have seen them then. But there was, so there's dog shit everywhere in the street, and a kid showed me how, you can take a branch and you bend it in half and you can pick up the dog shit, and then you can use it as a slingshot and throw it at other kids. So, pretty quickly I learned to play dog shit slingshot, and it was like, all right, okay, this is not bad. There's things to do in the city, and we would – we would skateboard on, you know, we'd wait for the red light and we'd skateboard down a some steep New York hill, and which is, I can't imagine how dangerous it was. And we would, you know, we would do graffiti. It was kind of the early days of, I mean, we were doing, we were writing on just shit with magic markers, and it was, so that was, so you adapt. So within about 3 months I had adapted, and about a year later we went back to Minnesota, and I wanted to adapt. You know, you want to belong when you're that age.
Right.
And
right.
I went back to Minnesota, and our friends from Minnesota, my little neighbor friends, were all like, oh man, you've changed. And they, what they really were amazed at was the New York accent. So I had adopted a New York accent from my Minnesota accent, my previous Minnesota accent, which I think I have more of a Minnesota accent now.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so you adapt, and then I became the world's biggest New York chauvinist. I'm like, oh yeah, every place else is stupid, and California is just a bunch of airheads, and you know, New York is the coolest.
Biggest cultural advantage is you can make a right turn at a red light.
Yeah, exactly. So I was there. I was that guy. And so now, of course, I'm a California chauvinist because I've been here 30-some years.
You went through two vastly different, I think maybe two or even three vastly different New York cities, in that you passed through the 60s and 70s at the height of two or three major pop cultural revolutions.
Yeah,
you know, in the folk revival, which was pretty much going on while you were moving there.
Yeah,
the counterculture and all its various elements.
Yeah,
and ultimately punk, which, if you want to add another one, man, you got simultaneously disco happening.
Yeah, sure.
So there was, I mean, the magnitude of cultural impact that you happen to be in New York City for. You know, it's a fucking time to be alive, man.
It was crazy. I was there when the city went, you know, Ford to city dropped dead, you know, when the city went
right,
broke.
Right.
I mean, the 70s, you know, there was a point when you thought, well, nobody's going to ever be nostalgic for this shit. it was tough, and there was, and crime was just out of control, and it was just, you know. And, you know, and then crack started up, and things got that much worse.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, crack.
And can we say the same thing about Detroit, man, where you've been described, there's one description of you as a rock zealot. And I'm thinking, judging by what I know of you, it's pretty accurate. Between Detroit and New York City, I mean, you were right there. I mean, to talk about the middle of the storm, but you were at the peak of the fucking surge, you know.
Well, in Detroit, it was, you know, the by the time I got there, I mean, Iggy Pop was still hanging around, and I got to, you know, meet him, and I tell a story in the novel about meeting Iggy Pop. I was waiting for an interview with David Bowie. I was waiting in David Bowie's hotel room for an interview, and the you know, it was all kind of dark, and you know, they had scarves over everything, kind of the way Keith Richards does. And I'm sitting there in this room, and I'm realizing, wait, there's a guy asleep on that bed over there, and I'm looking, and of course it was Iggy. So that's how I met Iggy Pop. He was sleeping, and I didn't know.
There's a lot of similar stories related to Iggy. When people meet him, he's either comatose, or he's just not conscious somehow.
Yeah.
Or they're holding him upright, or they're trying to force him down, walking him down the stairs, or walking him onto the stage or something.
Yeah. It's amazing he still made it. But Detroit had kind of those guys, you know, the Stooges were broken up, and the MC5 were broken up. And so, you know, Bob Seger was just making his national move at that point. So I remember the first week I was there or something, they had a press thing for Bob Seger. And so it was kind of, and of course there was, you know, Motown was still, let's see, when did Motown move to LA? I think it was the last days
of
Motown.
Mo West was like in 1971, I believe, is when Barry Gordy set up offices in LA.
That was, you could argue that was the end of Motown, but I don't really think it was. But So there was a sense of, it was the after the party, you know, the place was a mess, you know, it was, you know, they plowed under all the buildings that burned during the riots and the insurrection. And so, you know, you'd have a building, and you still have this. I've been back in the last few years a couple times, but you still have, you know, one really nice kind of row house, but no row. You know, it's just a weedy field around it. The ruin porn of Detroit is quite compelling. I know Detroiters complain about it, but there's some shit happening there. You know, there's some shit happening there now. And I remember I hung out at that Jack White's Third Man Gallery record store there when I was last there, and I enjoyed that.
Nice.
So, yeah.
How did you get involved with Cream? Did you come like a few years into it, or was it already established, or were you?
I went to Cream in 75, and I came from New York. I had actually spent a year out in San Francisco, and I met out in San Francisco one day. I had played in bands since I was 12 years old, and so by this time I'm like, you know, 19 or something, and you know, I'm just when the band gets somewhere, we got an agent and we had our first little tour, and you just think, oh yeah, here it goes, you know. And somebody did a radio ad for us. We were playing at this big club, I remember, and out in Rhode Island. We did a little New England tour. And then, the guitar player quits. The drummer quits. You know, so-and-so gets in a fight. The bass player gets in a fight. So I'm like, okay, this happens every time you get close with a band. You know, it's a cliche. It's Spinal Tap. And so I decided, fuck it, I'm going to go. I was a singer, and I decided, okay, I'm going to go do something that I can do by myself without band members. And so I moved from New York to San Francisco for a year because I had been there once, and I thought it was so beautiful. And I came out knowing nobody. And one day I was looking for an apartment, and I was looking for a cheap apartment, and I was really having trouble, and it was the end of a long day. And I see this basement apartment in the hills of Sausalito, and I'm like, you know, for rent. And I'm like, oh, shit, okay, pull the car over. I'm running across the street because it was competitive. And the guy's coming from the other direction carrying a box, and he says, forget it, I got it already. You know, he was not a very friendly guy. And I'm like, ah, fuck. So I said, can I, you know, you will let me look anyways. He says, yeah, you can look, but don't get any ideas. You know, he was kind of a hard ass. So I went in, and I'm looking at this basement. I just want to get a sense of what was for rent. And he comes in and he puts the box down, and underneath the box that he was carrying, he's wearing a lanyard with a press pass. And I said, oh, hey, what? You know, why you have a press pass? He says, well, I'm a writer and an editor. And I said, well, who you write for? He says, you know, Rolling Stone, Cream. I'm the West Coast editor of Cream, you know, Esquire. He goes on and on. And I'm like, oh, shit, I'm trying to get into that field. And the guy, it turns out it was Ed Ward, who was the, you know, I don't know if people know him. He was one of the original editors of Rolling Stone, the original record review editor, I think. Mm-hmm. And he was, then he went on to be the rock historian on Terry Gross's Fresh Air show on NPR for like 20 years.
Oh, okay.
And this is a guy who knows everybody and everybody knows him.
Right.
And so he said, well, anyways, he said, well, I'll help you out, but first you got to transcribe this tape and you got to do this. So he made me kind of his little slave for a while. And he said, you know, you do all this. And the truth is he kind of taught me what to do. So by making him his slave. And he also introduced me to a guy named John Morthland. In fact, we ate dinner, the three of us ate dinner together, like every other night. And, So then after I, you know, knew a little bit, Ed gave me an assignment. He gave me a couple of small assignments for Cream and for one of the city magazines out here, and a couple of interviews and reviews. And then I'd also met this guy, John Morthland. And John Morthland got a gig as the interim editor at Cream. So Cream had lost, you know, we went through a bunch of editors after Dave Marsh left. And so John Morthland was there. He was going to, he's a very good editor, and he was going to clean things up. And he called me. So by this time I moved back to New York. I know the story gets complicated, but he calls me and he says, "Hey, you want to come out here and be a copy boy at Cream?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I do." And not because I was such a great admirer of Cream, is I needed a job. And I, you know, getting an editorial job, that was something else. You know, I was used to, from my New York vantage point, I thought of the Cream as that, oh, that's that Detroit thing, you know, where all they write about is the Stooges and MC5. And, you know, and Grand Funk Railroad. I said, what the fuck? And but I went, and Lester Bangs and John Morthland picked me up at the airport in Lester's funky red Camaro, and we all went to Squally's bar and Italian restaurant and got shit-faced, and so I started working at Cream, and it was great. I completely came around on the MC5 and the Stooges, as Lester did. Lester wrote a terrible review of the MC5's first album in Rolling Stone, and later they forgave him. But and so I came to love Detroit and love Cream. It was just, it was an amazing job, and it ruined me for any other job after, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. I wanted to ask you, you know, Cream being pretty much by I would say most of all accounts I've heard, man, there's no rules, no guidelines, because you guys are literally inventing it, you know.
Yeah,
And you as managing editor, what did that entail, man? Did that mean that everybody's work was passing through you for approval, or was there any such thing as approval? I mean, what were you doing?
Well, there, you know, it wasn't like, oh, that's okay and that's not okay. It was more like, you know, you'd have to shape up things, and you'd bother the outside freelancers. And, you know, so I went from copy boy to managing editor because, again, they had such, after Marsh, they had such trouble keeping editors. And so I had not been at it long. And Barry Kramer one night said, "Hey, let me give you a ride home." And he got me in his car. He says, "How would you like to be editor?" And I said, "Well, yeah, okay." And he says, "You know," and I said, "But, you know, it's never going to work with me being editor and Lester being, quote, unquote, under me." I said, "So why don't we make, you know, Lester's not going to be the organized guy. Why don't we make Lester, give him the title of editor, and we'll give me the title of managing editor, and I will be the guy who keeps shit together." And Lester gets his the honor of being the editor. And, you know, and because basically Lester would, up until then, Lester had kind of killed off all the editors. That's why there were interim editors and stuff like that. This worked like a charm. I was 22 years old. I'm thinking, wow, dude, that was kind of sharp. So I got to edit Lester Bangs too. That was amazing. I remember I tell the story. I do tell the story in Loudmouth, because Loudmouth is a novel, but it's a, you know, there's a lot of facts in it, and a lot of my, you know, it's largely my memoir. But I decided I wanted to pursue it as a novel. But I tell the story about, you know, Lester taking a handful of pills, and in this case they were Valium, and I'm thinking, oh yeah, that's going to work out well. And then he would stay up for a day and a half and write, you know, 100 pages about John Denver. And the thing about it is, any the rest of us, if we did that, it would be all shit. But with Lester, if you're willing to persevere and go through it, you know, 50% of it would be gold. It was like,
it became poetry, man. It was like prose.
And it was kind of easy. To me, I found it easy, in a way, easy to edit them, because there was stuff that was just like, yeah, well, whatever. And you could, it was just kind of easy to take chunks out of it. And, you know, so like that story in particular, became like there's a story, a Cream issue with John Denver as God on the cover, John Denver in a manger, and I haven't read it in years. Maybe it's terrible, but I remember at the time if you edit it, I said, dude, we could do this, we could make this work. So I had a great working relationship with Lester, and we became great friends and drinking buddies. When I got to New York, I got the cheapest apartment in New York. I mean, I my wife says it was $150, but I think it was $200. But and when the apartment next door came, it was a shithole. But when the apartment next door came open, Lester was always talking in Detroit. I'm going to New York, and I'm gonna be. This is fuck. Detroit sucks. You know, you've seen the
T-shirt. Piss Factory. You know, it's like Patti Smith. Man, I'm going to New York.
Exactly. So I called him up and I said, dude, you're always talking about coming to New York. There's an apartment next door to be empty. It ain't gonna be empty long. I said, you want me to give the guy a deposit? And he said, do it. I'm coming. You know, so we were very close, and working there was great. It was amazing.
You guys were right off Union Square, right?
Oh, you mean in New York? Our apartment was 14th Street and between 14th and 15th on 6th Avenue. 542.
That was later.
No, that was our New York place where Lester and I lived, and we were about two long blocks from Avenue blocks from Union Square. Union Square was not nice at the time. Union Square was. You wouldn't walk through it unless you had to.
Yeah. I want to get into Loudmouth a little bit up ahead, but the reason I asked about what your role as managing editor and things pass into your hands is I always I love the story that you told on Three Sides about doing the review on the Kiss solo albums and hearing back from Wenner that Rolling Stone, you know, well, you tell the story.
Yeah, Dave Marsh, who was the original editor of Cream and went to New York and became the record review editor of Rolling Stone. So when I went to New York, I called him up and we went out to lunch, and he said, I'll give you some assignments. So I started writing record reviews for Rolling Stone. That was cool. And then the Kiss albums came in, those Kiss solo albums. And Marsh assigned them to me, and I dutifully wrote a review. I guess I reviewed all four of them, but I did review all four of them. I can't remember if it was in one review or four, but and Marsh, you know, we edited it and all that, and you know, it was sailing along. It would have been my biggest piece ever in Rolling Stone. He was planning on giving it a prominent place, and I had written it, you know, I don't entirely remember, but I'm sure I approached it somewhat tongue in cheek and as I often did with Kiss. And then I was very excited that I get a nice byline. And then I got the word from Marsh that Wenner killed it. It's like, Wenner killed it. Yeah. I didn't know. He said, oh, you know, it's too brash and silly and whatever, you know, it was kind of Cream style, you know, mm-hmm. and it was like, no, you know, Rolling Stone wanted to be the New Yorker. They wanted to be, you know, literary. And I mean, I wanted to be literary, but in a different way. I like kind of the more, you know, wild stuff. But I think the real reason, I found out later was it just Wenner hated Kiss. So,
any secret.
So he killed that thing. Well, it was a secret to me till I got killed. I was just crestfallen, you know. That was going to be my big shot in Rolling Stone.
Well, so, Wenner, I mean, the whole Rolling Stone / you know, it was like the elitist camp, you know, and they were often, you know, credited and with these accepted versions of rock and roll.
Right.
You know, in other words, there's, and I'm going to borrow from Bob Dylan here, you know, the story small s, and then there's the story capital S, where every word has its big letter and small letter.
Yeah.
And the story that most people have accepted over the decades is pretty much what's been connected to Wenner, and how the story capital S has largely been written by Rolling Stone and guys like you and Lester Bangs differed from the rest in so many ways, obviously the most significant factor in all of that is that you guys were not afraid to insult rock stars and even make them look bad, you know? Can you speak to that a little bit?
You mean the dynamic of the cream dynamic of humor and
I'm going to challenge that, though. I don't know that that's actually a cream dynamic, man, because it was the writers, man. It was you guys, because you guys took that attitude, that dynamic with you wherever you went, you know, whatever you wrote for.
Yeah, so a bunch of us happened to land at cream at the same time. So, but, you know, it's amazing that we didn't get pushback. And, when I went, again, I was 20, 21 or 2 when I arrived there, so I hadn't been out in the world that much in real jobs, a job working in an office. So I was in for a shock when I left Korean. I didn't realize that you couldn't do anything you wanted at other jobs. So it was in us for sure. I mean, I didn't learn to be like what I liked in terms of writing or music for that matter before I didn't learn that at Korean, although I did learn a lot about music, but they allowed us to go with our gut and to be, you know, a lot of that stuff, those insults and stuff were meant to be funny too. I mean, I would say that humor was, you know, 50% of it. But yes, we took it onward and I feel like I look at my own writing today, a long time later, and I think, I still kind of write the same way I did with cream. When I see an old something I wrote years ago, I think, oh shit, that's the way I write now. So that's
well,
messed up.
Called the cheerful punk gonzo fuck you-ism that Chris Gow.
I remember I was really drunk down at the Mud Club one night, and I got in a little bit of a shouting match with a well-known kind of writer, kind of more mainstream writer, and whose name shall go unmentioned, but and she said to me, stop acting like Lester. And I thought, I always act like this. I've been acting like this long before I knew Lester. So, but, you know, it looks like that. It looks like, oh, Lester generated all these people, but certainly, you know, he was an influence, but
yeah.
Anyways, but they let us do it, you know. They let us do it at Cream, so that I give Cream credit for providing the space, the room to do it, and almost never pushing back. And even when they'd push, you know, Barry Kramer, the publisher, would push back, you could push him.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one day he came into my office, and I just keep a really messy office. So I had this shit everywhere on my desk. You know, the desk was such a big pile of crap and papers and crap, and that you couldn't really use it. So he came in one day, and you know, he had a few of his cognacs that he liked to have at night, and he decided he would just run his arm along my table and sweep all the shit off onto the floor to be funny. And so I'm like, okay motherfucker. And again, this is my boss, and he's like 10-15 years older than me. And I went into his room, and he says, no, don't do it. And I just cleared off his desk completely, dumped all his shit on the floor. That was the way we were.
Mm-hmm.
So we were brash.
Artist-wise, is there anybody in particular that you got into trouble with?
Oh, God, somebody who got mad at me? I don't, you know. I had nothing like Lester and Lou or...
I think it's in terms of things like of like Lester recounting the story about getting a lot of shit for Frank Zappa's bad review of a Frank Zappa album. And Frank Zappa just paid for $10,000 on an ad in Cream magazine, so you better call him and tell him why you gave him a bad review, that type of thing. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well,
in terms of that.
Yeah, they wouldn't, you know, Cream wouldn't have... wouldn't have caved, you know, because Barry was Barry Kramer, the publisher. Have you seen the documentary yet?
Not yet.
He was you should see it. It's really good, and he was a shit disturber. So,
do you mind if I ask what happened with that documentary? Because it was supposed to be out. Like, I've been hearing about this forever. Now I'm seeing the reviews everywhere, and is it finally getting a proper release now?
Oh yeah, Yeah, it's out as of last Friday. So it premiered at South by Southwest, but it didn't have a distributor yet. So that's not atypical of South by Southwest. So they looked for a distributor, and I got to be good friends with the director, Scott, so I know all this from the inside, more or less. And they spent a long time looking for the right distributor. They wanted somebody who would put them in theaters as well as, you know, streaming. And, of course, by the time they got a great distributor and they got this Greenwich Entertainment, and those are the guys that did that recent Linda Ronstadt documentary. They did the Laurel Canyon documentary. They've done a whole bunch of stuff over the last 5 or so years. And right. So they were very happy, and they were going into theaters, and then the plague hit. So that's what happened. It was
that's
supposed to
another
be
another factor. Yeah,
it was supposed to be in theaters in June. So last Friday it went into quote virtual theaters. You know, have you seen they do that around here? And so it's in virtual theaters. I don't know, for a couple of weeks, and then
yeah,
it'll
I know
be,
it's available on a website. Somebody like that has a
right,
link to that.
Right, and and those things are all tied to. The movie theaters, and then it goes into streaming on Amazon like the end of this month or beginning of September, and there's going to be a DVD and everything. I wound up getting involved with it, but I think it's really good, and I'm really happy to see that Cream is getting its due.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it. Getting into Loudmouth a little bit.
Yeah.
I guess it's needless to say that Thomas Ransom is Robert Duncan, or at least based on Robert Duncan.
For sure based on. I hope he's not exactly me, but he's cooler than me, and he's but yes. Oh, definitely, you know.
I like what you said, though, about the I know you've spoken at length about
right.
it.
Right.
About the idea that hypothetically doing this book is a memoir as opposed to a novel that involved looking over your shoulder a lot at the actual facts.
Yeah. I didn't want to have to do research into my own life. And I also wanted to write about people that, you know, some of them are still alive. So a lot of them are dead, but some of them are still alive. And I thought, well, you know, I don't want to get into like some war with somebody. And I just didn't want to be, you know, held down by the facts or by the boring parts. I didn't, you know, I told you, I've been telling you, oh, I moved from here to here. And I'm like, I had that in the manuscript at one point. I'm like, that is so boring. Just let's get rid of that.
Yeah.
Forget, let's move this scene from California to New York. And you know, it's a better tale. And we all make shit up as, you know, when you tell a story in a bar, you're not telling, you're embellishing and you're, so I thought, you know, it's one giant bar story, this book. You know, my friend Sylvie Simmons described it as picaresque. So it is like a series of adventures. And I thought that was a good, she's a limey, so she knows words like that. But I thought series of adventures, I thought that's, you know, one character goes through a series of adventures. That's kind of what it is. And a lot of it's rock and roll. A lot of it's, there's a bunch of Cream in it. There's one of my favorite chapters is a Lester chapter. I kind of try to understand Lester through the lens of our early days in New York, sharing a floor in an apartment building. And then there's some, you know, some of my crazy childhood stuff where how I wound up, or how Thomas Ransom wound up the loudmouth that he became or always was. So there's, definitely based on my life, but with the boring parts left out.
Speaking to the boring parts, because you helped me figure out why I made some of the decisions I made on one of my own projects, which I could easily have done as a memoir, but didn't. And that, you know, this thing I've got coming out next year. But the thing with memoirs, man, is that the story or just the guts of the book is pretty much almost 95% ready made. You know, it's there.
You just need
to weave it into something that's interesting. It's like Stanley Kubrick said, you know, he said, yeah, we have the truth, but is it interesting?
Yeah.
So, as far as being accountable to people, there's also that, you know, I'm sure maybe you didn't want, you know, you didn't want to get a phone call from Tom Waits saying, you know, well, you know, that wasn't Bruce Springsteen in the car with you. It was me, you know, or why did you tell or just things like that. You know, people saying, well, it didn't happen. That didn't happen. Or this isn't the way it happened. Or, you know, just so you have that license and that creative freedom to do it that way in a novel. So, yeah, man, I totally get it.
Exactly. And, you know, like I think of a book like, you know, which I loved when I was in high school and I still kind of love it, but On the Road. So Kerouac, he wrote the that was a memoir, but he just changed the names, you know. So Allen Ginsberg is whatever he is, and it becomes
Dean Moriarty,
right? And so it's like I'm like I had a several editors say to me, "Why don't you just make this a memoir?" And I'm like, "Because I don't want to make it a memoir because it's not a memoir, it's not entirely factual." And I don't want to be bothered to go figure out what the facts are. The book starts with this. It's one of my favorite things is this driving in this car with Bruce Springsteen in Cleveland, which is a thing that really happened. And we had a guy I knew driving us. And I had said, hey, this guy, he was a Cleveland resident. I said, why don't we get this guy to show us around Cleveland? And so the three of us driving around the Junker in Cleveland, it was really just a magical day. And the guy was just, he's a crazy, drunken, druggy guy. I loved him, but he was the world's worst driver. But I didn't remember all the shit about him driving. So we have another friend who is a terrible driver. So I just kind of overlaid him onto my friend in Cleveland. And that's what you can do in a novel. I don't remember what his car was. And it doesn't matter, you know. He drove a Junker, you know. But I can give it, I can say it's a Falcon, and that's okay because it's a novel. I can just make it up. I can be cavalier about the facts. But the truth, as I said to somebody, is like, I'm not cavalier with the truth. This is the truth of the matter. But it's sometimes built out of imagined facts.
The names, man, are just, I mean, my mind is blown when I just go over the names. I was just going through your bio and Springsteen and Bowie, Freddie Mercury, Keith Richards, Jimmy Page, Aerosmith. I mean, you get the picture, man. It's just like, it's endless, man.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I was going to ask you about your own, I'm cautious about using the phrase musical heroes because I'm thinking you and Lester Bangs were almost cut from the same cloth in a way that I know he really rejected the idea of musical heroes, I suppose, you know, where he didn't seem to believe in the star system in music the way it was in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But regardless, who were your favorite artists before you got into writing, and did you meet or become friends with any of them? And I'm not talking about peers of people roughly around the same age as you. I'm talking about people that you were into before the whole trip.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had this crazy gangster brother who introduced me to Elvis Presley, but when I kind of came of age musically, you know, fourth, fifth grade, and the Beatles hit, you know, the British Invasion hit, all that stuff, which, you know, that just blew my mind. You know, it's a cliche, but the Beatles are, you know, really, that was where my life took a left turn. That's when I started playing in bands. And, you know, I was in the one band in my grade school. I was in the one band in my high school. So, and I was, you know, by the time I got to high school, I was doing, you know, I was looking over at Alice Cooper, you know, kind of cross dressing, and I was doing all that shit. I start with the Beatles and the Stones and the Yardbirds and the Kinks and all that British Invasion stuff. And I, you know, and I loved some of those San Francisco bands too, you know. I didn't love the Dead at first. When they got the Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, I loved those. And then I went back and I think there's some great stuff early on. I don't accept the whatever. The crowds are goofy, but or they were goofy, but That was kind of interesting. But there was a band, Janis Joplin's band, Big Brother and the Holding Company. I thought Janis was great, but I loved her band. And I remember when her manager, she was managed by the same guy, Albert Grossman, who managed Dylan and the band then later. And he kind of pried her away from that band, Big Brother. And I was a great admirer of them, in particular their lead guitarist, Sam Andrew. And the funny thing is, so I started playing in bands, and I was playing around New York. And one day a friend called me up and said, hey, would you come down to the Cafe Bazaar, which was, it was a famous place, but now it had lost its liquor license. And basically, you know, it was a fruit juice joint where junkies could go and drink fruit juice and nod for an hour for $10 or something. But this guy said, I'm playing at the Cafe Bazaar, and there's going to be a special guest and blah, blah, blah. And so I went down there, and it turned out it was Sam Andrew came down and played with us. He had left San Francisco and come to New York. And the next day I got a call from the drummer in this band, and he says, hey, Sam wants to get together. And so we went out to lunch, which was something I never did. And he said, do you want to be the singer in my new band? And it was like, so I was this huge admirer of Sam's. He invited me to be in his band. But this was the point I had decided, fuck bands. I'm going to go do something I can do on my own and be a writer. And I turned down one of my musical heroes, which is,
wow.
I don't know. That was kind of amazing at 20 or 21.
It's so admirable, man, I'll tell you that.
Well, I don't know. So the other bands I love, you know, I, again, coming out of the Beatles stuff, I became a big Todd Rundgren fan. One time, one of my early interviews at Cream, I got to interview Todd Rundgren, and he actually said, well, why don't you come up to my house in the country? And he drove the car. He was going out with B.B. Buell at the time, you know, B.B. Buell, mm-hmm. He was a
sure.
model, and yeah, you know, what's her name? Liv Tyler's mother. So Todd and B.B. drove me and my date up to his house for the weekend, and you know, that was cool. That was really cool.
Awesome.
I mean, it goes on. Hanging out with Springsteen was great. You know, he invited me to come down visit him at the Shore, and I was so broke at the time. I didn't want to tell him. You know, I didn't have train fare. I didn't have car fare. It was like,
can you recall roughly what year around that was? I'm one of those people that have superior autobiographical memory, so I can pinpoint exact dates in ways that a lot of people can't. But is this around the time where, I mean, Bruce was obviously signed at that point?
Oh, yeah, no, this is like late 70s. This, you know, either it was, I can't remember if it was before the Darkness tour or after. Maybe it was after. It was probably 78.
Yeah.
So.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the previous thing when we went to Cleveland, that was like 76 or 5. That was before the dark. That was before he went had
Cleveland
his 3-year.
Was a big place, right?
Yeah, and that was before he had his 3-year kind of down period when he was fighting with his manager and trying to make John Landau his manager.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, the lawsuits and fighting for creative control, and you know, they wanted to do some crazy things.
Yeah, yeah. But going to Cleveland, man, going to hanging out with that opening thing in Loudmouth is just like that. That was a day. That was a crazy day. It brackets the book. That story brackets the book. So
I'm going to be honest. I've scanned over the book in PDF because that's something that only came to me a few days ago. But I'm going to buy the book and wait for it to come because I'm like, are you like me in the sense that you have to have a tangible book in your hands, or have you adapted to digital print when it comes to reading entire books?
I've adapted to digital because I have my house is covered in books. I just have books and records everywhere, and so it's like I can't handle having another book, and a lot of them I haven't read, you know.
Yeah.
I just love books, so but a lot of them I haven't read, and so I'm like, forget it. And, you know, I, the last, 10, 15 years, I traveled a lot. for work, and I so it was way easier to take a computer or a Kindle or something.
Yeah.
I've switched over, and I don't mind it. I like it, and I mark up my, I highlight shit in the book, and I enjoy it reading digital.
Yeah, it's something I have to adapt to in terms of I just recently started using the Kindle. Well, not the Kindle itself, but just the way they call it, the Kindle of PC.
Right, right. I use it on my iPad.
Yeah,
well,
I'm in front of the computer most of the time anyway, so.
Well, there's going to be an electronic book of Loudmouth. That's, in fact, done. The files are all in. So
mm-hmm.
there's going to be, on the release day, there will be a print book, a digital book, and an audio book. So.
Yeah, I think we're both going through the same thing right now, because I'm getting formatted for the ebook myself.
Yeah.
And
just
worked out the thing. Well, I'm done going through Ingram, so it's more, I'm on my own here. So it's,
yeah.
But
your book's distributed by Ingram.
The print version, yes.
Yeah, that's great. That's who's my publisher is Three Rooms Press in New York, but they're distributed by Ingram, and Ingram gets your book everywhere.
Yeah, man. Well, that's I wasn't going to do it that way, but the girl who's doing my formatting kind of sold me on it. So,
that sounds great.
It's something I'm looking forward to. It's something that I tried to avoid for a long time, looking for an agent. And a lot of publishing houses won't read a writer that doesn't have an agent. And it's like I said, turning 50 was eye opening in so many fucking ways, man. It just got to the point where I said, you know what? I'm just putting this fucking thing out as an ebook.
Yeah.
If it comes into a print version, fine. And luckily it did. So
yeah,
but
that's great.
That's cool that we have that coincidence, man. That we
congrats.
Both have coming on October. Congratulations to you, man.
Well, I'll have to start a podcast and interview you.
Well, here's what I want. We're coming up on an hour, so I don't want to keep you all night. But I just want to say to encourage every Rock Under Fire listener out there who loves rock and roll, not just the music, but the history, the mythology, the whole fucking trip. A writer who puts as much energy and wit and attitude into his work as some of the best rock and roll itself. Get a copy of Robert Duncan's Loudmouth. Now you can pre-order this now, right?
Oh yeah. Oh, it's out.
Yeah.
Amazon, a whole bunch of places.
Aside from Loudmouth, where can people go to find out about you or any other projects or anything that you have going on?
I have a website. My writing website is DuncanWrites.com. Like writes, writes words.
W-R, yeah.
W-R-I-T-E-S, DuncanWrites.com. And, I have a blog that I've been doing the last few years about this little town we live in and outside San Francisco. And I got all the Loudmouth stuff is on there now. And links to all the buying, the buying links and pre-ordering
links.
I'm going to
put those links up myself on our site, on our page.
Yeah.
But
they're all there. And they're also at the publisher, threeroomspress.com. And that's three spelled out. Threeroomspress.com if you look Loudmouth in there, they got all the links too.
I checked out the playlist that they asked you to make for
your
to accompany your book. That was really cool. It's a great idea. But before we wrap up, I owe you a personal story.
Yes, please.
So it's 1978, and I'm 8 years old, and in the suburbs of Fords, New Jersey, as we talked about before we hit record.
Yeah.
But I'm 8 years old, and I'm obsessed with Kiss.
Yeah.
And maybe you've heard this story many times from many different people, but this is my version. I get bad report cards. I get in trouble at school and this and that, and everything is blamed on Kiss. Everything bad in the world is Kiss's fault, man. It gets to the point where my mom is like, that's enough with the kiss. You're obsessed with this fucking kiss. No more kiss, you know? So yeah. We walk into a drug fair. You know, the drug fairs in New Jersey at the time. Walk in and you smell, you know, you smell the lawn fertilizer and rubber beach balls and just that combination of smells of, that can only be associated with a drug fair. But, and she's walking toward the back of the drug fair to go to the pharmacy, and I kind of wander off into the magazine section where I used to look at the circus, look for circus and just see what pictures of Kiss I could find.
Yeah,
because I didn't read the articles at the time. You know, it was it was more of a picture. Cut the pictures out, tape them to my wall, and there I see four big, beaming, reddish, pinkish letters, KISS, man, glaring at me, man. Come hither, man. and there was one copy left, man. So I grabbed that fucking thing. I was like, oh my god, man.
The book was for sale in drug fair. It was an actual book.
Yeah, it was an actual fucking book about Kiss, man. I can't believe what the fuck I'm holding. So the backstory of this is my friend Tom. I turned him on to Kiss, man. I discovered them I was six. All right, so here I'm 2 years later. Now, hey, I had one album. I had Rock and Roll Over. He went and very quickly got all six of their records at the time, up to Love Gun or Alive 2, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So this is a summer of 78, so I suppose Double Platinum was their recent album. But anyway, so I'm like, I have to have this fucking book. I got to show Tommy I got this book, man. Like, I got something that he doesn't have. I'm begging my mother for it, man. She's like, no more kiss. So I bring it up to her. It's the only one. It's the only fucking book. It's the only Kiss book in Ford's, because I was like, that's it. They're not going to reorder any of it. This is the last one in existence, to an 8-year-old, man.
Wow.
So I show it to her. She's like, no. So she looks at the book. She goes, my mother's like, Robert Duncan. Oh, okay.
What does that mean?
So my aunt is there, right? My aunt's there. And she's like, actually, it was my mother's aunt. And we get in the car, and she's in the car, and she used to watch me. And she was like 80 or something. I don't know, maybe she was 70, whatever. Yeah. But she was old.
She was probably 40, and she just seemed old to you.
Maybe, man, maybe. But I show her the book, and she's like, oh, Robert Duncan. So I'm like 8 years old. I didn't think anything of it, But now that I look back on it, 40-something years later, I'm like, did they actually know who Robert Duncan was, man? Or did they think he was Roger Grimsby or something? Or what were they thinking, man? But anyway, he drives me to my friend's house because I'm going swimming with them in the pool. And, I bring my book. So they drop me off. I go into the house. I'm showing my friend's mom the book. She's like, oh, my God, wait till Tommy sees that. And I go out on the deck, and I'm waving my book. Tommy, look what I got. And his little brother, Christopher, 4 years old, with the swimmies, those inflatable swimmies that he got on his arms.
Yeah, sure.
He jumps out of the water, and he's running up. I can still see him dripping wet, grabs the fucking book out of my hand.
Oh,
man. I mean, you got to understand, man. I was the king of the world, man.
Yeah.
I had the biggest dick in Ford's that day, man. I had the fucking only Kiss book in existence in my hand, man. And he took that book and he flung it in the fucking swimming pool. Yeah, man. So I ran home crying, man. But I got my book back. The rest of the story goes is that, we dried the book out, and I went through life with this very crumpled Kiss book by Robert Duncan. Many years later, man, I found that book, and I threw some weights down on it, some steel or it was cast iron weights down on it, and then I forgot about it again, and then years later I found it again, and then the book was all flat, and I couldn't open it because it was a static cling. It was like the book, the pages were all stuck together now.
Oh man!
So and then finally a couple years later, the book just like literally split down the middle. So now I hold it together with one of those potato chip clips that you close the bags with.
Yeah.
So, I mean, all these years later, I got the same book, man. I should send you a picture.
That's fun. Yeah, dude. That's really fun.
And the whole incident is in my, the memoir disguised as a novel that I did that's coming out next year. So you're in my book.
Oh, shit. That's great.
I wrote this years ago, but you know. But anyway, so that's my story.